So today it's a pleasure to introduce Sherry Suyu. Many of you know Sherry already since she's currently visiting as an Emmy Noether Fellow along with many of her students and collaborators and visited here in the fall as well. So Sherry is a group leader at the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics in Munich and also faculty at the Technical University of Munich. Sherry's a leader in the field of strong gravitational lensing. She was one of the first people to use strongly lensed systems to constrain cosmological parameters in a landmark 2009 paper. And since then, she's really been one of the pioneers of pushing this program further. She's the PI of the Holy Cow project, which is the most prominent project constraining cosmological parameters from strong lensing.
And most prominent acronym as well.
That's true. recently she's been extending her methods developed for galaxies and quasars to analyze the lens supernovae in anticipation of new data sets. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Kendrick, for the kind introduction, and I really like to thank you for having me here. I've really enjoyed my extended visits here as part of the Emmy Noether Fellow, and as well as so did the people of my group and also collaborators. And I particularly like to thank Kendrick and also Neil for hosting us during our long visits. So today I'm happy to tell you about cosmology with gravitational lens time delays. So over the past decade or so, a standard cosmological model has emerged, namely the so-called flat lambda CDM model, where the universe is spatially flat and composed of dark energy described by the cosmological constant lambda and cold dark matter, CDM. So this flat lambda CDM model has described very well observations of a universe, especially on the large scales. But nonetheless, in recent years, there are some intriguing tensions showing up between observations and predictions of the standard cosmological model. In particular, there's now a lot of debate on the Hubble-Lemaître constant, H0. So H0 is an important parameter in this cosmological model because it sets the age, size, and critical density of the universe. And it also sets the present-day expansion rate, namely if you have an object at a distance d away from us, it is moving away from us at velocity v, that is simply H0 times d. So this is now known as the Hubble-Lemaître law. Shown here are some of the recent H0 measurements from various probes. So on the top left here, you have the value of H0 inferred from observations of the cosmic microwave background, CMB, using the Planck satellite. And you get a very precise measurement of the Hubble-Lemaître constant with better than 1% precision in this flat lambda CDM model. Shown here are the measurements from the WMAP satellite, also another CMB experiment, together with the South Pole Telescope, Atacama Cosmology Telescope, baryon acoustic oscillation experiments, and again, assuming the flat lambda CDM. And these red magenta points here are more direct measurements of the Hubble constant. So here, this is the red points are from the local distance ladder with the value here from Adam Riese's SHOES program. So this plot is taken from Riese et al. And then there's other direct probes such as strong lensing, SD clusters, and also water masers. So a lot of discussion is happening right now within the cosmological community because the value from Planck and that of the distance ladder are in tension with each other. And in fact, since 2016, the two collaborations have improved their measurements. They've gotten both more precise, but their central values haven't changed much. So now we're at sort of close to 4 sigma tension between these two measurements. And if this tension is not due to systematics, then this would imply new physics beyond the standard cosmological model because the value from Planck assumes a flat lambda CDM model. So if you relax any of these assumptions in this flat lambda CDM model, for example, if the universe is not spatially flat but has a curvature that is more negative, then the value from Planck would actually increase and become more compatible with that from the local distance ladder. Or if you have more relativistic species in the early universe, the value from Planck on H0 would also increase. Or if dark energy is not described by this cosmological constant with dark energy equation of state W, that is -1, then again, the value of H0 from Planck could increase. So to address whether this tension is really significant, whether we need new physics, beyond the standard flat lambda CDM. We need independent methods to overcome the systematics of each approach, especially the unknown unknowns. And one such method is strong gravitational lensing. So shown here is an illustration of the bending of light due to gravity. Suppose we have a background star here. As the light from the star comes towards us in the solar system, the light wave will get bent by the gravitational field of the sun and comes towards us on Earth in this direction so that we see the background star to be here instead of here. So this bending of light by gravity is gravitational lensing. And before telling you more about lensing, maybe let's step back a bit and look at lensing of more familiar daily objects. So shown here is strong optical lensing. Suppose you have a candlelight here, and if you put the base of a wine glass in front of the candlelight, you can actually produce multiple images of the candlelight as shown here. There's one, two, three, and there's a fourth image behind the stem of the wine glass. And if you change the tilt of the base of the wine glass, you can actually get different image configurations. As shown here, you have two image systems instead of four. And if the wine glass is perfectly aligned along the line of sight to the background candlelight, you can actually see a full ring. This is the so-called Einstein ring, and the radius of this ring is the Einstein radius. So next time at the wine party, you can have this a dry, have a go at this, and I guarantee you will see this before getting too drunk. So strong gravitational lensing is not too different from strong optical lensing. Essentially, we just need to replace the candlelight by an astrophysical object like a quasar, and the wine glass by, for example, a massive galaxy, because mass bends light and acts like a gravitational lens. So if we do this kind of replacement, we get a system here. So this is a quasar. Light ray is emanating from the quasar, normally in straight lines. But with the presence of a massive galaxy between the quasar and us on Earth, light rays get bent, and we see multiple images of the same background quasar around the foreground lens galaxy. And so here is another example of a strongly lensed quasar system observed with a Hubble Space Telescope. The light emitted from the quasar is actually powered by accretion onto supermassive black holes at centers of galaxies. So as things fall in to the center of black holes, it heats up and the thermal radiation is emitted. And because accretion is not uniform, the radiation emitted by quasars changes over time. So if we observe the system over time, we will actually see each of the four images flicker. So this is the monitoring of this lens system done by the Cosmogirl collaboration. So Cosmogirl is the cosmological monitoring of gravitational lenses. It's led by Frédéric Corbin in Lausanne, who was actually also visiting Perimeter last week with several people from Lausanne, also greatly enjoyed his visit here. So you can see these are the light curves obtained for each of the four images, A, B, C, D, in the four covers, so A, B, C, D. And you can see that each of the four images show variability. As I mentioned before, it's variable, and they actually show the same kind of variability features. This makes sense because the light is coming from the same quasar for each of the four images. So you will see the same variability pattern in each of the four images, but they are delayed in time in that this bump is occurring at different locations, and although this bigger dip is also located at different positions in time. The reason is the different images take different light paths to reach us, so there's a path difference between the multiple images, and also there's an additional gravitational delay due to the presence of the lens. So the net delay that we see in these light curves is a combination of this geometric delay due to the path difference and the gravitational delay. Now we can measure this delay by shifting the light curves and then also adjusting for the amplifications from lensing to get the time delays. And when you do so, you actually see that each of these light curves, in fact, actually have the same variability patterns. So Niyayash here has actually also developed a curve shifting method with one of his former students. So this time delay is actually related directly by this equation to a distance to the lens system. So this is the so-called time delay distance. So t here is the time delay, c is the speed of light. D delta t is a combination of three angular diameter distances that we have in lensing. It's from us to the lens. lens to the source and us to the source. Okay? And by construction, it's this combination of three angular diameter distances is mainly sensitive to the Hubble constant. In fact, it's inversely proportional to it, but it also depends weakly on other cosmological parameters. And the time delay also depends on the Fermat potential shown here, which is related to the mass distribution of the lens. So for cosmography, that is to measure this distance and thus constrain H naught, we need several things. In particular, we need to measure the time delays, as I just described, by monitoring these quasars over time. We need to have a model of the mass distribution, that is, you know, this foreground lens, because that affects the Fermat potential. So we can do so using constraints such as the positions of the quasar images, and more importantly, the extended ring that you see due to the host galaxy of the quasar that is lens into a ring. And this ring allows us to constrain accurately the lens Fermat potential. And also, we need to have some knowledge of mass structures along the line of sight between us and the background quasar source, because that also weakly perturbs this Fermat potential. But once we have all these three things, we can get T, we can get phi, and we can infer the time delay distance and constrain H naught. So the advantages of this method is that it's based on simple geometry and well-tested physics, namely general relativity, and it provides a one-step physical measurement of a cosmological distance completely independent of the distance ladder. So the method has been known for over 50 years. It was first proposed by Refstell in 1964. Nonetheless, getting the delays and also doing the mass modeling has been a lot of challenge. It was difficult to get each of these three ingredients, but there's been a lot of progress over the past decade or so. And with this, my collaborators and I started the HolyCal project that Kendrick mentioned. So our goal is to measure the distances to each of these five lens quasar systems and consequently constrain H naught to better than 3.5% precision. So shown here are the Holy Cowers, who I owe many of my thanks to. There are several of us in US, particularly in California, many of us in Europe, and a couple of us in Asia. And our goal is to establish time delay gravitational lenses as one of the best cosmological probes. Shown here are the latest results from Holy Cow. So we have analyzed these four lens quasar systems. So we have developed our method with this first lens. And then we applied similar techniques to these three lenses, and we did a blind analysis in order to avoid confirmation bias. Namely, during the analysis, we always blinded the, when we plot the probability distribution of H0, is always blinded with respect to the mean, so it's offset with respect to the mean. We don't know what value we're measuring until we're done with the full analysis and we unblind. So this is important because it avoids confirmation bias. And also, this lens is the latest one that was analyzed by Simon Bearer in UCLA. It was done using a completely different code that Simon has developed, whereas the previous three was modeled using Glee, a software that Alexei Hokola and I have developed. So after analyzing these four lens systems, here are the results of the H-naught distribution for each of the four lenses in the four different colors that you show here. So this is H-naught and the probability. After checking that these four probability distributions are statistically consistent with each other, we proceed to combine the measurement from these four lenses, which we can because the four lenses are completely independent with completely independent data sets. And our joint constraint on H0 from the four lenses is 72.5 plus 2.1 minus 2.3, which is a 3% measurement in flat lambda CDM. So shown here is our value from Holy Cow. This is Adam Rees's result from last year from the local Cepheids distance ladder, the SHOES project. And since our measurement and Adam Rees's SHOES programs are completely independent with different techniques, we can actually combine the two results and get the local H-naught measurement shown here. And on the top left here, this is Planck, and with also DESBAO DN. So you can see that there's now the tension is more than 4 sigma with this combined result, although we do know that our measurement is actually within 3 sigma of Planck. So I wouldn't say we're in direct tension with Plunk yet.
Can you say a few more words how you obtained such a 3% precision, given that the answers you get are quite spread?
So this is basically a product of the likelihoods of the, so each lens system essentially gives us a distance measurement, the time delay distance, d delta t. And then we can constrain any in any cosmological model, its cosmological parameters, given these four time delay distance measurements with their probability distribution. And then that's this black curve. We can talk more of the technical details later.
Yeah. How far away are these sources?
So the lenses, they vary between redshifts of 0.3 to 0.7.
So it's more like a local.
It's local compared to the CMB.
More was the local one.
That's right. So the and then quasars are around redshift 1-2-ish. Yeah. Okay, so our time delay method and results have actually generated quite a bit of attention, even outside the academic circle. However, not all the press have reported accurately. So you can see here, this is how some people are interpreting our results. Nonetheless, we got a good laugh out of that. So looking forward, we have three more lenses in the pipeline that we have almost all the ancillary data. So there's this lens here, and also this other one that was observed with ground-based adaptive optics imaging with Keck. And these two we're currently analyzing through, again, our blind analysis. So this one is led by Eddie Ruzu and Kenneth Wong in Japan. And this one was by Zifan Chen in UC Davis. And we're actually very, very close to the end of the analysis. So it's a very tense time now. And we're going to unblind sort of in the next couple of months. So stay tuned. And so far, as I've shown in Holy Cow, each lens gives us a distance measurement of about 5 to 9% uncertainty depending on the quality of the data. Now, how do we actually improve on this per lens? It's because much of the uncertainty in our distance measurement is actually due to the uncertainty in the lens mass modeling, how well we can constrain the mass distribution of the foreground lens. Now, lensing has its model degeneracies. So to break these degeneracies, we need more data. And in particular, stellar kinematics is actually a very helpful and complementary data. So Akun Yildirim, who is a postdoc at MPA working with me, and also visited us at Perimeter last fall, he's developing a self-consistent joint lensing and dynamical modeling of strong lens systems shown here. So here, this is on the left, is one of the Holy Cow lenses with Hubble Space Telescope imaging. And then Akun simulated James Webb Space Telescope near-spec observations of the foreground galaxy and show what its stellar kinematics would look like, as shown here. So this is a map of the velocity, the line-of-sight velocity of the foreground galaxy, so you know around 300 kilometers per second. But you can see that it's spatially resolved, so that's the key thing, what we can do with JWST. And then he went ahead and modeled the mock data set from JWST and also the Hubble lensing data. And from that, he can constrain the time delay distance, as I described before. So shown here is the distribution of the time delay distance if you use lensing only. And basically, the bimodal distribution you see here is due to two lens models that are essentially degenerate with each other. And if you have the 2D kinematics, you can actually break the degeneracy of lensing, and you get this much tighter constraint on the time delay distance from lensing and dynamical modeling.
So why are there two peaks?
Yeah, so this is essentially the mass sheet degeneracy. So if we try the different models, they actually give peak at different distributions. And if you include kinematics, so basically these two models fit the lensing data equally well, essentially a manifestation of the
But it's not just like a continuum of...
If we explore lots of models, essentially you would get the continuum. But the question is, you know, are all of these models physical, right? So we use physically motivated models, and then that restricts us to some range. And then you still have degeneracies in these different models. Now, in order to break these degeneracies, lensing can't do it. because there's the matching degeneracy, so you need to basically have other data set like stellar kinematics to give you another mass measurement.
So the lensing only has two peaks, right?
Yep.
Okay, and then,
yep,
then you add dynamics, then you pick,
yep,
one of the peaks.
Yep, with spatially resolved kinematics.
So the holy cow likelihoods that you showed before were unimodal.
Yep.
Does that mean that you had dynamics for those?
So we had single aperture average, and it already breaks some of the degeneracy, but not as drastic with the 2D kinematics. And also, if we have a stellar kinematic measurement of the foreground lens, we can actually measure directly the distance to the lens rather than this time delay distance, which is a combination of the three distances that I mentioned before. So if you measure directly a distance to the lens, this is helpful for constraining dark energy because the angular ramp distance to the lens is more sensitive on dark energy parameters, whereas the time delay distance is mostly sensitive to H0. So this is actually shown by In Ji, who was a postdoc at MPA working with Eiichiro Komatsu and myself. So the time delay scales roughly as G over M. And the lens velocity dispersion scales as GM over R. Definition of angular diameter distance is R over delta theta. So you can see that if you take the ratio of these two equations, the GM cancels out, and you basically get R. So you can substitute R with basically delta t over sigma squared, and you basically get the distance to angular diameter distance to the lens scales roughly as that. And what In has shown is that this dA is actually insensitive to line of sight structures, but it does depend on anisotropy of the stellar orbits in the galaxy. So basically that is our limiting uncertainty. We don't know the anisotropy of the stellar orbit. So that's where you need really 2D kinematics. But with a single aperture average velocity dispersion, which is our current data, we can measure dA with about 15% uncertainty.
You also have some, you know, like some issue with just like the shape of the object. So how do you break that degeneracy?
Yeah, so these are things that are to be tested, but already just from single aperture, so Akon is showing this, now that he actually developed a 2D, he can test if you have a single aperture average velocities, assuming spherical symmetry, do you get biases? And we don't really see any significant bias. It's more that the uncertainty is huge.
Yeah, but with 2D, you don't get like this component, right?
You do if you have the 2D resolved kinematics, because the 2D kinematics depend on the 3D shape of your mass distribution. So you do have information about your 3D mass distribution.
It was all projection, so I don't...
That from lensing. The lensing data is sensitive to the projected mass distribution, but the
right.
kinematics is sensitive to the 3D mass distribution.
Yes, but you're only measuring a projected kinematics measurement.
That's right. But the projected kinematics measurement does depend on your 3D mass distribution,
right.
What you assume. So yeah, I forgot to mention, we currently assume it's axisymmetric 3D. And so this is going beyond what we've done before with spherically symmetric. But nonetheless, if you really want to test it, you need to go to like triaxial halos.
Right.
And this is something that Akun is thinking of.
I think the point is that you just see line of sight velocities. So that's not enough to break the degeneracy for anisotropy of the orbit. So that's, that's still an unknown.
That's right, but you do have some constraints. It's true, there's still model degeneracies in the kinematics, but the thing is that degeneracies in lensing and degeneracies in kinematics are quite orthogonal. And basically the lensing, you can get very accurately the mass enclosed within the Einstein radius, whereas stellar kinematics, you can get very accurately the mass enclosed within a 3D effective radius, and these radii are different, and basically you break degeneracies when you combine the two. All right, so with previously what we have is lensing plus single aperture kinematics, and In has shown you can get uncertainty distance measurement with uncertainty about 15% per lens, and Akun shows that if we have spatially resolved kinematics, like 2D kinematics, we can actually reduce this uncertainty down to about 3%. Although we have to be very cautious, especially just given discussion, this is actually highly sensitive to any systematic errors in our kinematic measurement. So that's we have to be wary of these things as well when trying to measure the kinematics velocities from a spectrum. There's also systematics errors there that this method is more sensitive to. Nonetheless, so Akun is going to have the paper all on this very soon. We're just finalizing a few things now. So Akun was looking at the kinematics of the foreground lens, but we could imagine doing also kinematics of the background sources. So this is what Julia Kirivi is doing at MPA. So this is part of her PhD thesis with me. So Julia is now simulating basically stellar kinematics of the background sources and see how that helps us both to understand the mass distributions of these high redshift galaxies, which you can't really probe otherwise, and also how this would help us constrain better the foreground lenses. So what we have seen so far essentially is something like a source intensity of the background galaxy. When it's lens, it would look like an arc like this. And then this is the foreground lens light. So far, we've been working mostly in the intensity for the background sources. But if we have, for example, the near spec on JWST, we can actually get kinematics of the arcs. So basically, Julia has now simulated the source kinematics, assuming some mass distribution of the source, lens it, and then this is what the kinematics of the lens source would look like. And she's basically combining now both data sets, the lensing intensities and also the lens kinematics of the sources, to see how well this helps in improving our mass models. So with Holy Cow, at the time when we started, we basically pick out the best lenses that we have with time delays. There are not that many because lens quasars are quite rare. But nonetheless, the situation is changing thanks to many of the current imaging surveys. So in particular, we have now the Hyper Supreme Cam survey that is imaging over 1,000 square degree on the sky with excellent image quality with using the 8-meter Subaru telescope in Hawaii. There's also the Dark Energy Survey, and there's a program called Strong Lensing Insights into Dark Energy Survey that Tommaso Threw is leading. And with DES, there's about 5,000 square degrees. And there's also the Kilodegree Survey, also covering over 1,000 square degrees. So with these surveys and also others, we expect to find hundreds of lens quasars. And my collaborators and I actually have been finding new lens quasar systems with these imaging surveys. So shown here is a gallery of some of the new lens quasar systems that we've discovered in DES, PanSTARRS, and also SDSS Atlas. So on the left, you show these are Hubble Space Telescope imaging follow-up that we've obtained on these new lens quasar systems. And the right is showing a reconstruction of the image system that is done by Anwar Sajib at UCLA. So we are getting now more lenses. So most of the search efforts so far are based on imaging using multiple filters, so have colors and imaging, but it's otherwise static. There's no information about the temporal variation. But as I told you before, quasars, they vary, their light changes over time. So in principle, we could use the variability to also find lens quasars. And this is the work of Danny Chow, who's a PhD student at MPA, also visiting a Perimeter right now. As you can see, she's wearing the Perimeter t-shirt. So with variability, basically we can see the different quasar images vary at different times. So for example, we have an observation at a particular epoch that's called this a reference epoch, and we can have it at a later epoch that's called the ith epoch. You know, by eye, you can't really see the difference, but if you take the difference of these two images, you'll start to see differences. This image is brighter, and then these two are fainter compared to the reference, okay? And the reason why the residual is different at each of the different images is because there's a time delay between the multiple images. If time delay is zero, basically you would see the same residual pattern in each of the four images. But because of the time delay, we can actually see the difference image over time. And this is what you can, a simulation of the ideal case that Danny made. And you see that each of the quasar images is varying. And you'll see this kind of variation pattern over time. So we can use this variability feature to find lens quasar systems. So what Danny did is she simulated realistic mock lens systems and run the whole Hyper Supreme Cam imaging survey pipeline on it to simulate also all the realistic observational artifact features that you get from doing this pipeline reduction. So shown on the top top row are difference images for a lens quasar system in different epochs. So you can see the different four different images show image residuals. And in the bottom for comparison is a variable source that is not strongly lensed, that is seen with a hypersupreme cam survey. And the key thing you'll notice is that, you know, the size of the residual for a mock quasar system is bigger than that of a non-lens. The reason is when you have strong lensing, you see multiple images, and they all vary, so you're going to get a big area of the residuals. And whereas if it's not strongly lensed, typically you just have one image, either a variable star, supernova, what have you, is typically just, you know, size of the PSF. In fact, there are very few transient sources that are spatially extended like we would get in a lens quasar source. So actually, Chris Kachanik years ago suggested extended variability as a good way to find lens quasars, and Danny is investigating this. So what we can do is we can detect lens quasar candidates using the size of this image residual. So for example, we can set a threshold. If the size is greater than some threshold, then it's, you know, likely to be a lens quasar. If the size is smaller than the threshold, you know, like this case, it's not a lens. So from the sample of mock images and also the variable sources, Danny is able to compute the true positive rate and the false positive rate. And as you can see here, this is the ROC curve of true positive rate versus false positive rate, receiving obturating characteristics. So ideally, we would like to be in the top left corner with 100% true positive rate and 0% false positive rate, okay? But in reality, we're not going to get that. But we try to get as close as it to possible. So Danny splitted the sample into different lens samples. So you have bright lenses with white separation. Let's focus on that one that's red. And you can see that we are actually getting pretty high true positive rate with low false positive rate. So Danny's next step is to basically run this new algorithm on the hypersupreme cam survey to look for new lens quasar images, new lens quasar systems, especially the bright and white separation ones. So far I've told you about lens quasars, but when Ref Sal first proposed this time delay method, he was actually envisioning lens supernova. So you get, you know, multiple images of a supernova appearing in time, and you can measure the time delay. But as we know, supernova is rare. Strong lensing is also rare because you need to have, you know, chance alignment between the lens and the supernova at cosmological distances. So when you have, you know, to get two rare events happening at the same time, you kind of have to hit jackpot. Nonetheless, people have hit jackpot in 2014. So this was the very first discovery of a strongly lensed supernova in a galaxy cluster, shown here, Max 1149. So the orange blobs that you see, these are galaxy clusters members. So these are sort of galaxies residing in a common cluster potential due to the gravitational interaction. So they're all gravitationally bound. And behind this galaxy cluster is a spiral galaxy that is strongly lensed by this cluster into three images. So you can see one here with a zoom, two here, that's the zoom, and the third one, okay, and this is the zoom. So this one you can see very clear, it's a nice grand design spiral. And it happens that actually one of the cluster members in the foreground is lying near one of the spiral arms of this image, further lensing the spiral arm into multiple images. And it happens that a supernova went off in this exact same spiral arm and was observed when Hubble Space Telescope was taking imaging of this galaxy cluster as part of the Hubble Frontier Field. So from that, you actually see these, you know, red points. These are the multiple supernova images. This is more clear. So this is this same panel, but observed in different HST filters for the different colors and before 2014. So this is like the reference template image. And the middle row is again the same area observed with Hubble, but now in November 2014. And in all three filters, you see that there's this additional point images popping up. And if you take the difference, you can see it pretty clearly. Okay, so this is the very first strongly lensed supernova that was discovered by Pat Kelly and collaborators. And It was named supernova Refstel in honor of Refstel, who had the idea of seeing this phenomenon, you know, 50 years before it was discovered. And now the interesting question is, if a supernova appears in this image, it must also appear in these other two images, right? Because it's the same spiral galaxy. So the key question is when. So let's call this middle image SX and the top image SY. A supernova was first discovered here. So when the supernova Refstel was discovered, there was actually already a mass model of this galaxy cluster, because this is a known cluster. It's one of the max galaxy clusters, an image with Hubble. But from this initial mass model, they found that the time delay of SY was actually in the past, about 15 years before this image. So the discovery team actually went to all the imaging archives to see if there was any signs of this image SY, but unfortunately there isn't. Nonetheless, the same mass model predicted that SX should happen after this first image. But the uncertainty was between 1 year and 5 years, which makes the follow-up quite difficult. So how do we get better predictions of this time delay? Well, to get better prediction, you need better mass model. To get better mass model, you need better data. So we have already very good HST imaging data. So then Claudio Grillo applied for director discretionary time at the ESO, European Southern Observatory, to get MUSE observations. So MUSE is a 1 arc minute by 1 arc minute field of view, essentially covering this whole area. IFU, integral field unit. So you can basically get spectra of most of the galaxies in this field, which is important because then you can separate cleanly what is the foreground lenses and what are the background sources. Because otherwise, there's a lot of contamination when you try to model a cluster. You might misidentify a background source as a cluster member and model its mass, which would then give you bad modeling results. So with the new MUSE data, we can perform better mass model. And so different modeling teams try to predict using the new data set the time delays of this image SX before the 1 year mark, because that was sort of the lower limit cutoff in the preliminary model. So the different color symbols here are the predictions from different modeling teams. So the y-axis here is the magnification, so it's the brightness of SX relative to the first image, S1. And this is the time delay of SX relative to S1. So notice that this is 300, this is 400. So basically, most of the models using the new data is actually predicting a short delay on the short side, sort of within 1 year. Okay. Now, this predictions was actually done before the end of October, actually. So we posted all our predictions before this cluster was visible again, and that was this plot. And at the end of October, this galaxy cluster was visible again, so Hubble went and pointed at it. But unfortunately, there was no sign of SX. And 2 weeks later, Hubble pointed again at it. There was still no sign of SX. And 2 weeks again, at the end of November, there was still no detection from Hubble. So this means, you know, when it was first discovered, it was November 2014. So by 2015 November, this 1 year later, it's still not detected, which means that you need to have a delay longer than a year. Right. So this means that these short delay predictions are essentially ruled out. And the prediction from our team is actually right here in red. So we're sort of hanging there on the lifeline. So this is from our team. This is led by Claudio Grillo. And you know, at the end of November, when there was still no SX, Claudio and I were getting very nervous because our model predicted with 99.9% confidence that, you know, SX should appear before the end of 2015. But you know, there's still nothing in November, end of November. Nonetheless, that year we got an early Christmas present, because when Hubble went back again in mid-December, they took this image shown here. And this is the reference image taken earlier in the year in April. So they should look, you know, almost the same, supernova that brighter. But notice here, there's some additional image that popped up. So this is image SX that appeared as we predicted. And so from that detection with Hubble imaging, you basically get a constraint shown in this banana contour, a 1 sigma and 2 sigma constraint on its magnification, brightness, and its time delay. Two particular models, two teams predicted correctly. There's a team led by Masamune Ogiri in Japan. And then there's our team. And important note is that when we did our prediction, we actually predicted with Glee, which is the software that Alexei Hakala and I have developed. And that is the software that we have been using for the quasar cosmology, basically demonstrating the robustness of our modeling approach. So in addition to just predicting the time and the magnification, we can also predict the location. So before the supernovas detected, these are the predictions from the different modeling teams in different with their different air circles, the 1 sigma air circles. And our team, marked by Grillo, is shown in green. And when the supernova actually happened, it was shown in the red cross. So notice this is 2 arc seconds on the sky. So we're able to predict the location of the lens supernova with better than 0.2 arc seconds. So the ref style basically is a core collapse supernova. And it allowed us to do this blind test, a true blind test of our modeling approach. But then a year later, with the monitoring data, we can actually see how well we can do cosmology with it. We can turn the problem around. Rather than predicting, assuming some cosmology, we can now use the time delays and try to see if we can model the mass distribution and infer cosmology. So we don't quite have yet the time delays from the supernova teams that have been monitoring the system. But nonetheless, Claudio, Piero Rosati, myself, and others have tried to perform a first feasibility study of using supernova ref style for H-naught. We do have the time delays of these first 4 images from Steve Rodney et al. And the long delay between SX and S1, this we have from that single detection. There is an estimate uncertainty from Pat Kelly et al.'s detection. So given these delays, we have tried to infer what the H-naught distribution would be, and that's shown here for the 2 different distributions, and blue and red just shows different time delay depending on how you measured it in Rodney's. It's very close. And what's important is actually the time delay of SX to S1. So we assume the 345 in this model. But if you shift that delay by plus or minus 15 days or plus or minus 30 days, that's basically where the peak will shift. So the H-naught from supernova RISA is highly sensitive to what this SX delay would be. So this should come out soon from the supernova team. So stay tuned. And once we have the delay measured, we'll try to do cosmology with the lens, this lens supernova. So as I mentioned, ref style was a core collapse supernova. In late 2016, there was another exciting event, and this was actually a very first strongly lensed type 1A supernova. So type 1As, as many of you know, are standardizable candles. That's actually what people have used to measure the accelerated expansion of the universe with the type 1A supernova intrinsic luminosities. So in the fall of 2016, Ariel Gubar and collaborators serendipitously found the very first strongly lensed type 1A in the intermediate Palomar transient factory survey. So this is an image shown here of that lens system. Top is the Hubble Space Telescope follow-up imaging, and the bottom is ground-based Keck adaptive optics imaging. So you can see that there's 4 supernova images, and then there's the 4 ground lens. Okay, so when I saw this, it was super exciting because it's a type 1A. Basically, you have 2 cosmological probes in a single system. And I was very keen to find out, what is the time delay of the system? Can we actually use this for cosmology? So my collaborators and I tried to model the system as fast as we could before the supernova fades. So this is Anuprita More using Glaphic, the software that Masamune developed, and then also me using Glaphic, using Glee. So on the top left, this is the HST image of the system. This one is the model from Anuprita with Glaphic, and this one is with Glee from me. And you can see that we're getting the global structure of the lens system pretty well. This is a residual image difference between these two. And from GLEE, we also get a reconstruction of the background host galaxy of the supernova. So you can see it's actually kind of funky. And then the supernova is appearing sort of in the middle. But from all the different mass models that we have done, what we found is that the time delays between the multiple images in the system is actually very short, less than one day. So we were kind of bummed by that because it means it will be quite difficult to get a precise measurement of the system. When your delay is very short, it's very hard to get a precise delay, especially if you cannot monitor better than a day. So nonetheless, the IPTF team is following up the system, so stay tuned of results from the IPTF. So with the discovery of these two lens supernova systems, it's basically turned strongly lensed supernova as a theoretical fantasy into reality. So with that, given this, my research group in Munich is starting a new project on lensed supernova called Cosmic Fireworks Premiere. It's funded by the European Research Council with 2 million euros for 5 years. And the goal of this project is to address two longstanding problems in particular. First one is, what is a progenitor of type 1a supernova? Is it single degenerate scenario where you have a white dwarf accreting material from a companion, and as it accretes, it increases its mass, and when it goes above the Chandrasekhar mass limit, it goes explode. So this would be the single degenerate. Or is it two white dwarfs that are in a binary system, and when they merge due to gravitational wave radiation, they explode? Or is it something else? So this is still not very clear after decades of debate on the progenitors of type 1a, even though observationally, empirically, they are standardizable. But their progenitor system is not known. So understanding their progenitors would actually help a lot in type 1a supernova cosmology. And then the second goal is to address what's dark energy, in particular, measure the Hubble-Lemaître constant using the time delay method that I've described with supernova instead of quasars. So let me tell you a bit more about how we can achieve these two goals. So the first one is supernova progenitors. So how can we unveil the progenitors? So the idea is that when a supernova is strongly lensed, you can detect the lens system based on the first image, sort of like what Refstell did with a supernova Refstell. You can then predict the location and time of the next supernova images as soon as you detected this first one. And then after the prediction, you can, because you know when and where it's going to happen, you can then plan your observational follow-up and to get the next images in their entirety. And observations of the first hours and days of supernova explosions are key to understanding the progenitor system. So shown here is actually the light curve of the absolute magnitude versus time and days for different progenitor scenarios. So if you have a single degenerate versus a white dwarf accreting material from a companion, when the supernova explodes, the white dwarf explodes, basically the supernova ejecta will impact onto the companion, and then the shock-heated material will emit thermally. This is shortly after explosion, and you will see additional radiation coming from this shock-heated material. And the bigger the companion, the more radiation you will see. So the green here is from a giant, whereas these blue and red are from main sequence stars. So the idea is that you actually see additional bump at the beginning if it's single degenerate. And if it's double degenerate, basically you don't get this additional thermal radiation. So observation in the very early phase is important to understand the progenitors. And in the past, you don't really have these observations, because by the time you find the supernova and arrange to get follow-up, you basically already lost the first few days. But with our project, because we can predict when the next supernova images are going to happen, we can arrange our observational follow-up and actually get the full supernova explosion and actually target especially this very early phase. So now onto the second goal, the cosmology with lens supernova. This is similar to lens quasars, but lens supernova do provide some advantages in that supernova has characteristic light curves, which allows us to measure the time delays more easily, because quasars are kind of stochastically varying and the variation is usually quite small. whereas supernova is like boom, you know, you have a 4-magnitude change in brightness. You can basically curve shift pretty easily. Lens mass model will be more straightforward as well, because when the supernova fades, you basically can get an image of the lens system free of bright point sources. So currently with lens quasars, the lens quasars are very bright. So trying to model the host galaxy of the quasars, it's difficult. But with supernova, once the supernova fades, you get basically a clean system for modeling. And also, as I mentioned, supernova is a standardizable candle, especially the 1As. So these are the advantages, but they are challenges, of course. So for example, there's microlensing of supernova by stars in the foreground galaxy that we have to take care of. So Frederic Corbon gave a cosmology seminar last week and described quite a bit about microlensing, so I won't get to it here. But nonetheless, we have to keep in mind this, this effect. And also, lens supernova is very rare, much rarer than lens quasars. So to find these things, fortunately, there's now wide-field imaging surveys in covering large area of the sky in cadence, so repeatedly. So in particular, there's a Zwicky transient facility, and shown here is a field of view of the ZTF camera. It's very wide, much wider than most of the imaging survey cameras. So Raul Canameras, who's also visiting Perimeter here, and so he's postdoc at MPA, together with Stefan Taubenberger, are leading the effort to find lens supernova in the ZTF survey. So this ZTF is actually scanning the entire northern sky every 3 days as part of a public part of the survey. And from this, we would get about 100,000 alerts of transients per day. And most of them will not be supernovas, lens supernovas. So there's only probably around the order of 10 new supernovas. So ZTF is very efficient at scanning the entire sky, because it has big camera field of view. But the thing is, the imaging pixels on these ZTF cameras is actually quite big. So we actually do not have good angular resolution, which is needed for strong lensing to resolve the multiple images. So we are now combining the ZTF with PanSTARRS. This is another imaging survey, now with higher angular resolution. But PanSTARRS, it doesn't have any time domain information. It's just a static survey, but it has higher image quality. So we can combine these two to try to find lens supernova from the ZTF survey. And we expect a few. The expected number of lens supernova from ZTF is on the order of 10. And actually, most of them will be very small separations, so not resolvable with long delays. And we're targeting the long delay ones in order to get the early light curve, early phase spectra.
Sorry, can I ask? So PanSTARRS is the static survey, isn't it?
There's also a transient part, but the cadence is not really good enough for lens supernova on the wide field. In terms of having a wide field and cadence, you don't have that. You need to combine with ZTF.
But do they cover the entire area that the ZTF covers?
Yeah, so it's 3pi. There's this 3pi survey from PanSTARRS.
So all these supernovae will have like host galaxies, right? And those galaxies are a lens, and so then, like, you know, wouldn't you then just use that in?
Good point. That's what we're thinking of. So yeah, so there's two different search strategies. First is to see from the transients, then look at from ZTF, look in PanSTARRS, see if it's lens. Alternatively, is first find all the lenses in PanSTARRS and then see which one of them goes to explode. Yeah. We're doing both, or we plan to do both. So we're just starting on this. I mean, Raul just started in January. So, all right, so the number expected is a few, but nonetheless, the idea is to set up the framework, because in the era of the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, LSST, we will actually have hundreds of lens supernova. So LSST is a high entendu survey telescope with about 7 meter effective area aperture. And it covers 10 square degree fields, but it has high angular resolution. The pixel size is better than 0.2 arc seconds, so we can actually resolve the multiple images with just LSST imaging alone. And it's a cadence survey. It's going to image the entire southern sky about every few days. And each visit will reach 24 magd in about 30 seconds. So it's very efficient. And also have image good seeing, because it's going to be in Chile. So basically, those give us about 10-year movie of the entire southern sky. This will generate about 120 petabytes of data. So for reference, a petabyte will basically contain every book ever published. This is probably peanuts compared to what the CHIME people are dealing with. Nonetheless, for optical imaging survey, this is huge. Like it's a huge amount for us for the first time. First light of LSSC is around 2020. And the full survey is expected to start 2022. There will be mini surveys in between during commissioning from which we can also start to apply the Lens Supernova search method. And as I mentioned, we expect to have hundreds of these things in the 10-year survey. Now, an important aspect of LSSC, especially the generated law discussion in the past year, is how should we actually observe with LSST? Like which, because you know, we have some flexibility, which area to pick, which filter, how long of an exposure. You know, there's all these different options that we can do that still allow us to achieve the four main science goals that LSST has, including weak lensing. So for Lens Supernova, these cadence strategies affect us because it affects, first of all, the number that we can actually discover, and then secondly, the time delay, the accuracy that we can actually measure. So Zeman Huber, who is a master's student in our group, has been looking into the LSST cadence strategy. So shown here is an example of a baseline strategy of LSST. So this is time. Each dot here is an observation, and the six different colors is just the six different filters that LSST has. So this is a 10-year survey strategy. So basically what Zeman did was he took mock lens systems and combined it with state-of-the-art supernova explosion models to produce theoretical light curves that also includes the effect of microlensing, and then combine this with the observing strategy to actually populate the data points on the light curves, and then try to run a curve shifting algorithm on this mock data set to see how well he can measure the time delays. And this is the final result from his analysis. So he basically ran on like 20 different LSST strategies. I won't go into the details, but they're essentially, you can categorize into like three main categories. There's a baseline in orange, higher cadence in magenta, so higher cadence than baseline, meaning you observe more frequently, and higher cadence, but with at the expense of fewer seasons in blue. So the LSC-only data basically will not give you a very high number of lens supernovas because that's shown in gray. This is the number of lens supernova for the different strategies. So you can see with LSST data only, basically it's just too sparse, the sampling. We can't really get the time delay out. So what we're advocating is that we should use LSST as a discovering machine, and as soon as we discover something, we trigger follow-up. Because then we can get a much higher number of lens supernova in some of the strategies. So from CMOS, we're pushing for LSST with follow-up for Lens Supernova, and then also the strategies with higher cadence. And finally, after we detect these things, we have to be able to model them quickly in order to predict when the next images is going to happen. So far, we've been relying on Glee. But Glee requires like a person to manually do the model, which takes time. And when supernova happens, we don't have that much time. So what Stefan Schultz, who is also visiting here, a PhD student in the group, he is now developing a new method to model lenses quickly with machine learning. So this was actually shown by Yashar Hezave, also Florence Levasseur. And Stefan is now looking into this for ground-based imaging survey. So he simulated realistic lenses with ground-based imaging. And then he's now training a neural network to see how well he can infer the mass parameters. So shown here is the result of one of the preliminary trainings he's done. So this is the input axis ratio of the mass distribution of the lens, for example, and this is the recover. So you see actually, you know, you can recover the axis ratio with some scatter, and then also the Einstein radius, which is basically related to the mass of the lens. So this is very preliminary. We're trying to work out better on the different knobs to turn in the neural network. But nonetheless, the idea is to be able to predict basically within, you know, a few hours the next images as soon as we detect them. What's the future prospects? Experiments and surveys in the 2020s, including Euclid, LSST, WFIRST, they'll provide close to 10,000 lens quasars and about 100 lens supernova. As you can see here, Euclid is going to be a space-based imaging survey with high angular resolution, so it's good for discovery. Also, LSS TSNode is good for discovery and getting time delays, and we'll have JWST for high resolution spectroscopy follow-up. So with that, I conclude here and summarize. Thank you.
Any questions from the students? From the general public?
What are the prospects? So you talked a lot about the lens supernova. The numbers that you're going to get there are still far lower than the rough order hundreds of quasars that you were talking about. So, I mean, I assume the quasar prospects for H-naught measurements are going to be an order of magnitude more precise than the...
That's right. But the thing is, to actually get each quasar to have a precise distance measure, do need a lot of follow-up. So you'll have like 10,000 lens quasars, but I think in practice you're not going to be able to follow up them all. So it's more realistic to, you know, get follow up for say like 50, 100 systems. Then in that case, given the follow up resources, I think a supernova, lens supernova with similar follow up would do better.
Does the standard candleness of the supernova help break some degeneracies, like sheet mass degeneracy or something?
Yeah, we're planning to look into that. So actually, during Zeeman's work, where he simulated a bunch of light curves, he included microlensing. So microlensing would boost your image magnification. And as a result, that adds noise to how well to determine the intrinsic brightness. But so we're planning to look into this. But at the moment, we don't quite know. But we're hoping to use that.
So I mean, related to that, I guess there was this flux anomalies for, I guess, strong lenses that would make the fluxes unreliable. I don't know if you're...
Yeah, so if there's substructure, indeed, Neil worked a lot on this before, you'll get flux ratio anomalies due to the substructures in the galaxy, and that would... in fact, impair your ability to infer the intrinsic flux.
So it's, do you have to basically not use the fluxes, just use the position, that's what you're...
Yeah, for the mass modeling, we're not going to use the fluxes. But it's more, can we actually determine the intrinsic supernova brightness? Because if so, we can actually use this as a standard candle. And
but that, if there is a substructure effect on the fluxes, then that's not very helpful.
That's right. So. It's to be explored. It's still quite new.
I mean, a related issue is that you were showing the ratio, I guess the time for this first ref style supernova, you're showing the time delay versus the relative relative magnification, relative brightness. But then I guess that would be affected, the relative brightness would be affected by substructure.
Yep.
So that would then necessarily be, I guess, very reliable. I mean, the time delay is much more reliable than the...
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But in the case of ref style, there are not that many stars because it's a galaxy cluster. So I think they're, it's a substructure.
Yeah.
They are, so the main substructures are included in that they are the galaxy members.
Right.
So in the galaxy, so you see them. Whereas in the galaxy scale case that we're now focusing on, the substructures are likely dark.
Yeah.
So then it becomes harder, yes. But I think for the purpose, like for the two goals I have described, this doesn't really matter in that we're not using the fluxes for our constraints anyway, so that's fine.
The results you get for the cosmological, I mean for the Hubble constants, how independent are they of the cosmological model?
They're, so from time delay lenses, there is dependence. So that's why when I quoted 3%, that is in flat lambda CDM.
That's flat lambda.
Yeah, so because we're measuring directly the distance, this time delay distance. However, the sensitivity on H-naught to different cosmological models is not so great because this time delay distance is only weakly dependent on the other cosmological probe. So if we have a different cosmology, we would get a slightly different H-naught, but not too different. Like it might differ by like a few percent.
Any
questions?
That's a question. Are these H-dot measurements currently limited by statistical errors on the time delays or systematic errors in modeling the lens?
I think it depends on the lens. So if some lenses, they have short time delays in symmetric configuration, then if the delay is like 10 days, where you're monitoring even every day, it's hard to get absolute uncertainties better than a day. In that case, your uncertainty on the time delay, precision-wise, would be like 10%, and that would sort of be the dominating factor. If you have a long delay system, where you can have delays like on the order of like 90, 100 days, then if you measure a delay with absolute uncertainty of 1 day, that would be like 1%. So then your time delay is subdominant, and your other modeling uncertainty, line of sight uncertainty, becomes substantial, like becomes a dominating one. Yeah. So it depends on system to system which error, which is the dominating source of uncertainty.
I see.
Yeah. But it's better now, I think, after we've learned from Holy Cow, we want to target long delay systems.
Which have big Einstein rings, right? Yeah.
Or a non-symmetric system, because symmetrics typically have short delay. So if we want a fold,
symmetry, yeah.
That's right, we want a fold or a cusp system, then we could have the long delay.
So on this note about delay, the large uncertainty, this sort of banana region for the Repstal plot that you show, mm-hmm. is this mostly just coming from the cadence of the 2 week measurements that are taken?
That's right, there's that. There's.
So you can do much better than that if you just.
Yeah.
Okay.
More questions? Let's take this big again.
Thank you.